So it's this time of the year where, I mean, it's not at all fun to be inside the class. It's outside is so much nicer. So I can put this on autoplay and stand outside. That would be fine. And I don't think you'll see much of a difference because we're coming to part of the course where I'm just maybe a few hours ahead of you in terms of, you know, putting things in perspective. I think, in fact, I have never really taught reinforcement learning other than making allusions to it in the various classes. So it'll only get worse. So eventually I will put this stuff on autoplay and, you know, you can read it yourself. But anyway, it's fun stuff. I assume that all of you have read the chapters, right? And the chapter on reinforcement learning. So I'm more or less trying to just follow the background in the book, but we'll go a little further afterwards. So before I go there, are there any questions on the probabilistic planning discussion, FFHOP, LRTDP? So you guys forget about it as soon as you leave. Yes, sir.
I don't know if you sent the, do you think it would be useful?
I don't know. There are many variations on, well, I don't know. I mean, it's one more paper. I think I'm not particularly sure that it's specifically useful either. I should mention one thing, though, that if you're reading probabilistic planning papers, they tend to evaluate themselves in two different ways. One, of course, is on the IPC model, which is online. So they would essentially try to give themselves like 30 minutes to solve a problem, and basically solving means that you make an action, send it over to the simulator tells you what happened, you make the next action. And then if you succeed by the end, then you got 1 point. If you failed, then, you know, you got 0 points on that problem, and then you keep doing this. So that's the online method. And then in fact many planners, like FFHOP for example, compares itself on the online method, okay? And as you saw, LRTDP, on the other hand, uses a different version. Basically, it looks at the quality of the policy. So in particular, they want to see whether or not values for all the states have actually converged, okay? So in fact, in one of the earliest 2006, I think, competition, there was a planner based on LRTDP called MGPT. Okay, don't ask me why they called that, but MGPT, which took part in the competition. And then FF Replan, as I told you, was the winner that year, and that was doing, you know, basically. Notice that even if, in fact, I tell you that I care about IPC, you can still decide to compute the optimal policy. So of the 30 minutes, you spend 29 minutes computing the optimal policy and 1 minute very quickly executing it. That's okay, right? So in fact, MGPT used that approach that year, okay? And FF Replan, on the other hand, used direct, you know, make a move and then wait for the answer before you decide the next move. Okay, so FF Replan actually used online solving. MGPT used more of a batch solving. In a sense, it computed the policy and then, you know, executed it. MGPT didn't do well, so at least on that particular set of problems. But you would see that several planners like LRTDP at MGPT, of course, and then some other ones like Kalobau's one, they compare their performance. If they say they improved their performance, they tend to say it in terms of, look, we converged to the optimal policy faster. Whereas these guys, if you go on this direction, you say, look, I'm able to solve triangle tire domain, you know, 100% of the time, as against my competitors who are only solving it 35% of the time. Okay, eventually they're all connected, obviously. You know, if you know that if you can compute the optimal policy in very small amount of time, then you can beat everybody. But that's basically, since it's not possible, the question is, should you spend time getting as big, as good a full policy as possible? Or should you just make a move and then see what happens? And, you know, those are the two different search strategies. The other thing, Karthik was talking about Kolobov paper. I can send you a copy. There was a subset of people here who were involved in that discussion. But basically, the important thing is, from if you look at it from LRTDP point of view, right? Remember, the big thing is the heuristic, which can be zero, but you need to set, you need to initialize the value function to some value to begin with. If you set it to zero, that would be admissible for at least stochastic shortest path algorithms, shortest path MDPs. Now, can you do better than that? In the paper that you looked at, the LRTDP paper, he looks at what's called H-mean. It's actually an interesting kind of a heuristic. You should look at it to see whether you can make sense of it in terms of any other heuristic you know. However, it turns out that H-mean is sort of, it's better than zero, but it's not particularly informative. Okay, an alternative idea for computing the heuristic for a state essentially is, so if you have a state S, remember LRTDP solver comes to a state S, looks at its value, updates the value of its neighbors based on the value of that state, and it keeps doing this, right? In the very beginning it comes, there should have been a value that is stored, and if that's not stored, and so the first value that you store in that state is the heuristic value. Okay, one idea is to just sort of put null in the beginning, so, and then when you get to that state, you compute, and if you get to the state for the very first time, you very quickly compute a heuristic estimate of the value. It's not a big deal. That can be done. So that basically means you don't have to compute the entire heuristic up front. You just compute the heuristic also for the state as and when they are first encountered. Okay. Now, if that is the case, if I come to S, so basically, you know, LRTDP essentially, you know, went from the way you would need it is, you went from S0 to S1, and now I can reset the value of S0 based on the value of S1 using the dynamic programming update, right? If only I know the value of S1. If value of S1 currently is null, that means it's never been set, you call a heuristic. Okay, this is just like A star heuristic. You know, remember in the way when you wrote A star algorithm, you would call the heuristic as and when needed. Okay, now the question is, what can you do if I have an S1? Imagine you are considering, you know, problems where a given goal state is what you're trying to achieve, not general MDPs, but goal-oriented MDPs, which is basically what, in fact, LRTDP looks at, that is the stochastic shortest path algorithm. Okay, stochastic shortest path algorithm, SSP. Okay, so now what I can do is I can consider basically computing the length of the path for going from S1 to G, and see whether that can be seen as an estimate. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay. Remember, if you have actually PDDL problems, there is a state here, there is a goal state here, so it's a planning problem right now. The problem, of course, is all the actions in the middle that you can use are all stochastic. So how do you use stochastic actions to very quickly compute a deterministic plan? Enter the idea of FF-hop, which is determinize. Okay, so what I can do is, when I come to S1 first, I can determinize the problem from S1 to G. Okay, so G is goal state, S1 is the initial state, and then my actions are determinized to have, you know, certain deterministic outcomes. The question, of course, is how do you do that? Okay, the simplest idea would be, I'll say, most likely outcome. If I use most likely outcome and I compute the length of the plan, you know, or the cost, the cumulative cost, will the heuristic be admissible? By the way, there is on a completely different note, I'm going to at some point of time, I mean, I was hoping to do it over the weekend, but I still really didn't wake up. I'm going to ask you guys a bunch of questions about how the course is going, and one of which I want to do is if we should have a midterm. Okay, and if I have midterm, I'll ask these kinds of questions, and you should be able to answer. Right? I mean, because I think we basically discussed, you know, this idea of if I can determinize this plan, this domain, such that most likely outcomes are used, and I computed the length of the plan, of a cumulative cost, would that be an admissible heuristic? Would it be less than the true cost? No. Okay? So, if you remember from the FF Hub, there were two kinds of determinizations. One is most likely determinization. That will not lead to an admissible heuristic. Okay? The second idea would be all outcome determinization. That means for each action, you essentially assume that all its non-deterministic effects are separately generated. So in particular, actually, if you have A1, which says P and Q with probability 0.5, and P and M with probability 0.5, right? Then you essentially have A11, which just gives me P and M, and A12, which gives me P and Q as the effects. So they have two actions now instead of one action. Okay? Now, if I now solve the deterministic problem with respect to this all outcome determinization and take the length of the plan returned, would that be an admissible cost? It would be an admissible cost because everything that is possible would have been looked at by it. It's less likely to be informed because even highly unlikely ways of going to the goal would be seen as equally feasible. Do you understand what I'm saying? So if you can draw the nice pictures about admissibility, right? I mean, if in fact the admissible V star is here, right? The most likely outcome is actually likely to be closer, but once in a while it'll cross. All outcome one is guaranteed to be below, but could be quite low. Right? Now, so if I do all outcome, right, then if I do all outcome based determinization, then I call a planner, let's say I call FF, which you heard of, right? I mean the FF planner, and it'll give me a plan, I take the length of that plan. Would that be admissible? But is FF guaranteed to give you optimal plans?
No.
So it's not.
But
No. Optimal and efficient are completely different. FF does not give optimal plans. It's not guaranteed to give optimal plans. It's an efficient planner. It's an efficient planner, but it can actually give you a plan which is costlier than is needed. It is costlier than is needed. So, having come to this, this is the only one that has a hope of being admissible, but if you run FF, it won't be admissible. Understand what I'm saying? Again, remember the difference between a computer scientist and an outsider is computer scientists know what they're losing as they keep losing it. You know, optimality is falling apart all the time, but you know where exactly this time around it fell apart. Okay, so if you took this most likely outcome, can you give me an example of how most likely outcome would have said that a plan, that the cost that it came up with is actually higher than the expected cost? Right? Because the most likely way actions will happen, you'll never have reached the goal at all. But there are some unlikely outcomes of the actions which will let you reach the goal, and so expected cost is not infinity. Expected cost is a finite number. However, if you take the most likely outcome, you'll get infinity as the expected cost. that's a classic way of proving that in fact it's inadmissible. Whereas if you take all outcome, so if you take most likely and take the optimal plan, it's still inadmissible. If you take all outcome and take the optimal plan, then it is admissible. But nobody really does optimal, they run FF when they are in doubt. That would be inadmissible. You say to act with it. Now in fact, if it is inadmissible, if you call FF and it becomes inadmissible, right, what parts of LRTDP falls apart? There is no such thing as cutting off. Well, there is a name for it. No, what I'm saying is, if I wind up using, what was I saying? let me just give me a second. What did I ask? I'm sorry. So what part of LRTDP winds up losing its properties, the desired properties, if you used FF to compute the all outcome determinization plan, which would be inoptimal, because of which the heuristic would be inadmissible? Who cares if the heuristic is inadmissible? What part of LRTDP dies because of inadmissibility? It's basically very close to what you said. It's label propagation. Yeah. Right? It's basically the label propagation. But, you know, the bounding is done in LRTDP in terms of label propagation. Remember the picture where you said, everybody around me already has high Q values, and I'm getting my current Q value from here. And so I never have to worry about it because they will only become higher and higher. And so I am solved. You can't say that if you have an inadmissible heuristic, because it can actually come down a little later. Okay? So people actually use FF and just go ahead with it anyway. Okay? Now, why use FF? Why not use FF's relaxed plan heuristic? I'm only looking for heuristic, right? You know, remember, if we didn't do all of this, a great heuristic is whenever there is no heuristic value, put a zero in it. That would be a heuristic. Okay, why am I killing myself trying to compute better and better heuristics? Informedness, yeah, but I mean, you know, informedness ultimately doesn't give you any badge if you die before, you know, getting the optimal action. Yes, it is more informed, so, but it's not obvious. Remember that picture that we drew in 471, which is the cost of computing the heuristic and the number of nodes it cuts. I mean, the amount of time you spend doing search. And the real question is, where is this? It could be that the costly heuristic that you're doing is somewhere here. So you feel good that so few nodes will be expanded with this very costly heuristic, but then you are quite far away from the minimum. You understand what I'm saying? It's an empirical issue. You don't quite know upfront as to which heuristic will work out. So zero is probably on this side. Okay? And I would say, in fact, FF, it's not at all clear whether it's here or here. I would tell you what is definitely here. What is here? Give me an example of a heuristic which is for sure is going to be that side. Yeah, so basically, when you are in S1, subroutine, call LRTDP to solve the value of S1. So in particular, solve the stochastic planning problem of going from S1 to the goal completely. Okay? I would almost argue that that's more or less what you're doing. You're trying to compute the problem of going from S1 to G, and you relax the stochasticity. Normally, relaxing stochasticity is a iffy thing. If you relax stochasticity, you get most likely outcome, and that's bad. Okay, but if you relax it in this all outcome case, then it'll be fine. It'll at least be admissible. Another way of relaxing stochasticity, by the way, since we are talking about it, is reduce uncertainty. In fact, I would say determinization is really just nothing but reducing uncertainty. But determinization is a reasonably extreme way of reducing uncertainty. Okay? I could, for example, consider a planner which is extremely good at dealing with actions that have at most two stochastic outcomes. So you can talk about these ideas of stochastic width, which is how many stochastic outcomes an action can have. And a really bad problem has higher width. A really good problem has what width one. I mean, zero is great too. That means you basically right away say there is no solution. Okay, the lower the width, the better. So what in general determinization is doing is reducing the stochastic width of the problem to one in the case of determinization. Instead of going all the way to one, I can say 2, 1.5. That will give me classes of stochastic planning problems that may be easier to solve than the original one. Now, I don't really right now know any planner which will be able to actually do better with a lower stochastic width than with a higher stochastic width. But theoretically, it should be feasible. Yeah, that's a question. So once you start doing sampling, then you have to take the, in general, if you take samples, then they can only be upper bounds. Okay, but they can be closer. Okay, so now as I'm doing this, I can also do FF relaxed plan heuristic, which is, you know, if I'm relaxing stochasticity, why not relax negative interactions also? Okay, so in fact, there are two things that can be relaxed and they are sort of independent. And I'm giving a separate lecture which I didn't prepare, so I'll go back and write the slide for this. But there are two things that you can, two possible relaxations. One is uncertainty. The other is negative interaction. You can do both of them, you can do one of them, you can do a little of this and little of that. And all of them are reasonable ways of computing heuristics. Okay, so in FF, if you use FF, you are completely reducing uncertainty to one, so you're becoming stochastic, which is becoming one, but negative interactions are left completely in because it is actually finding a feasible plan. If I took all outcome determinization and used FF relaxed plan heuristic, then I did both this and this. Right? Now, in fact, so that basically would be a faster way because relaxed plan heuristic, I mean, the more relaxation you do, the faster it is to solve the problem. So relaxed plan heuristic will be faster. And normally it won't be as effective as the one that takes, as effective in the sense of cutting down the number of nodes. You know, relaxed plan heuristic is more likely to be this direction compared to FF, which will be that direction. Right? Now, my question is the following. Since I put these two dimensions up, so I have kept this and relaxed this in the case of FF, relax both in the case of relaxed plan heuristic. Okay? Can I just keep this and relax this? Do you understand what I'm saying? Do you know any idea which will allow you to keep the uncertainty but relax the negative interactions? I claim that you know the idea. Yes. McLuhan. What is McLuhan doing? McLuhan is looking at multiple samples and it is trying to, so it is keeping the uncertainty, but it's ignoring the negative interactions. So McLuhan is going to be, so you can draw this sort of a, you know, I'm writing a mid-level term paper, so I'm feeling good. So you can draw a thing where essentially you say you have this kind of a dominance idea. So zero is dominated by everybody, right? And then FF Let's see. How about FF relax plan? FF relax plan is here. That dominates 0. FF dominates FF relax plan. MacLug dominates FF relax plan because MacLug is FF relax plan over multiple labeled graphs. Okay? And both of these, if you want to dominate both of these, you would need something like limited width stochastic planning. Okay? Kartik, are you writing this all down? So you have to make a slide for this. Okay? Limited width stochastic planning. So these are all different heuristics for solving the stochastic planning problem. And it's connected to FF replan, I mean FF hop, because it uses determinizations too, but for a different way. And here you are using determinizations for computing the heuristics and to compute the entire policy. Yes, sir?
So is that limited with stochastic planning kind of a research area? Or is it
the whole thing is research right now. I mean, this is whatever I said today in the class hasn't yet been said outside. Okay, but some of the stuff I said, probably people could have said it if they thought for an hour. Okay, and some of them, like limited width stochastic planning, I don't know how to do it. So it's definitely research area. Okay, but I mean, to some extent, to combine things, sometimes you have to go out of what's being done, because if you just see what's being done, they look like two different things. Okay, you have to sort of estimate. I mean, this I can do in this area because we've been thinking about this problem for a bunch of time. Now, this, all of this is Karthik's mistake, because he said, why don't you tell them about Kolobov's paper? And you don't know who the heck is Kolobov. But, you know, the point is, this Kolobov is this character who essentially computes FF heuristics at each state in LRTDP over all outcome determinization, which means, you know, on the big grand scheme of things, he's just one dot. One useful point about what he's doing is that if you were to compute FF heuristic, even though it's an inoptimal planner, inadmissible planner, every time you call FF, it takes a lot of time. So his argument in that paper is FF replan heuristic, FF relaxed plan heuristic is obviously much faster to compute, but it doesn't scale as well. So he in fact showed empirically that FF relaxed plan heuristic is somewhere here. That means it takes less time to compute, but it takes too many nodes to evaluate. Okay? And he has shown that FF basically is somewhere this side. That means it's better. So the extra time you spend on FF is more or less, you know, being made up in the reduced number of nodes being expanded. I mean, of course, nodes being expanded doesn't have a good metaphor in MDPs, but you know, think about it in that way. Okay, now the question of course is, if something takes a lot of time, you want to do a little less of it. Can I avoid calling the FF multiple times? If I just called FF for, you know, if I just called, think about the following thing. So I had the following scenario, and I need so this was the state I was in, okay, this is S1. And I called FF and it gave me a plan to get there. A little later, I got the following state. Do I call FF again to solve the problem or not? Clearly, you don't need to call FF again, because on the way to solve this problem, you solve this problem. Yeah? How do you figure this out? It turns out there's a technical term for this. If you have A1, A2, A3, etc., it is your plan, you regress the goal state over A3. Regress. Remember the regression from 471? And that will tell you what weakest conditions must be true before A3, such that doing just A3 will get you to the goal state. What would they be? They would be all the goal conditions plus the preconditions of A3 minus anything useful that A3 did. That's the regression. So now I would say in this case that basically the last thing probably is, let's say, putting B on top of C. And you could do this as long as, picking B from top of C and putting it down. So you can do that as long as you're holding B. So in any state we are holding B and C is clear, I have a plan. Do you understand? Okay. So in general, actually, when you compute a plan, it turns out that you have a plan not only for the state S0 to SG, but to a bunch of intermediate states that the plan goes through. Long, long back, this was called, in strips, they were called triangle tables. And these are useful because if you now started executing this plan, STRIPS was interested in actual execution. If you started executing the plan and you executed A1 and you looked at the state, and the state is not what you expected it to be, then you need to replan. But what if you lucked out and the state is not what you expected it to be, but it's better than what you expected it to be? That means you just basically put A on the table, but you are, you know, shaking so much that B also fell off from C. So everything is on table. So you're done at this point. So what STRIPS would say is, yeah, I know that this state where B is supposed to be on top of C is what I'm expecting. That's not true. But a later state is true. So I just start executing the plan from there onwards. This is triangle table. Very simple idea. Except what Kolobov was basically saying is, if you just remember, whenever you compute a plan, you remember, you hash it with not only with respect to the state that you computed it for, but all the partial states from which the suffixes of the plan can be executed. Okay? Then, obviously, it's a memory and space trade-off. Space and time trade-off. And he says that, in fact, it can improve the speed by like 25-fold over just not remembering. Not a surprising thing at all. Okay, and in fact, I think there are much more interesting ways of generalizing, a plan. If you have a plan, you can generalize in multiple different ways. Okay, but that's something, that's what Kolobov does, but from the perspective that we have here, and something that I think is worth remembering, is heuristics that you learned until you came here are useful both for FF-HOP model and LRTDP model. LRTDP just, initializes the heuristic. FF-HOP determinizes the problem and computes the plan. The question as to which is a better way of using these heuristics is still out there. The question as to which approach is likely to win big is still out there. Okay? Any other questions?
Doesn't the approach need to use where with the domain?
What? Well, yeah, possibly.
And shouldn't there, I would think there'd be something that you could do to pull apart the domain and determine how it goes.
My feeling is, yes, that's probably, my feeling is that's a second order. First, I want to get the spectrum of approaches, and then first try to find if there is a dominating approach among the spectrum of approaches across all domains. Okay. If there isn't, it's worth figuring it out. So I'm not against the domain analysis, but I am against premature domain analysis, because that goes against the grain of AI, which is, rather than write a domain specific planner, we are trying to write a domain independent planner.
Sure.
Okay, so.
But that's not to say that you couldn't have 30 planners. And then, I think you have someone who's trying to solve a problem in this field, right? And you have someone who's unfamiliar with the state of research. Now they have 45 planners out there, and they have a domain in their hands, and they go, now what? Right.
No, but the point is, if you go, so yes, that's a reasonable way to do it. But in science, in general, and kind of presumptuous to call computer science to begin with. But, and AI, who knows. But, the point is, in science in general, when there are 15 methods, there'll always be some people who will try to say, here's a portfolio-based approach for solving these 15 methods. Think of what happened at the time of Lincoln, Newton and Leibniz. Newton and Leibniz, right? They had two different ways of doing calculus, right? And of course, they're getting on each other's nerves. They're killing each other. Of course, one guy is dead. The other guy is going beyond the grave to, kill him. And as to my way of doing calculus is better. And then, you and I can come and try to say, look, you guys, there's a portfolio-based calculus. You know, in Europe, do this calculus. In UK, do this calculus. Eventually, only one calculus remained. Basically, Newton's approach was very cumbersome. And if we depended on that, in fact, the United Kingdom was set behind by close to 100 years by various people's reckoning in mathematical research, because for false prestige issues, they stuck with Newton's notation for calculus. And it turns out that Leibniz's approach was much better in terms of the notation. And this is just one example. There are others in other places too. So I would myself caution about premature portfolio methods. Okay, if you have to do something by next month, by all means, or even next 2 years, by all means, do premature portfolio method. I mean, it's not premature, portfolio methods. But if you have to make a research contribution, try to see if one of them is actually dominating. In fact, try to prove that they are incomparable. In fact, a very nice paper the paper that got one of the best paper awards in ICAP this year, essentially was looking at three classes of heuristics and trying to see whether one of them, any of them, are dominated by anybody else. And that paper is actually available in the videos. You know, this is Malte-Helmert and Kamel-Dohm-Schlag's paper. And one of the interesting points there is two classes of heuristics, it turns out they are incomparable. So if there is A, B, and C, A dominates B, C dominates B, and A and C are not comparable, then I do portfolio. So in fact, what they do is even better than portfolio. They find a way of combining A and C into an AC heuristic, which is better than both A and C. Okay, so for longer term research, I prefer that approach. For, you know, about 3 months later, my employer wants me to use something that's existing, I prefer portfolio approach. Okay?
But how much portfolio approach has been researched as far as actually doing domain analysis?
There's a bunch of papers. We can talk about offline. We talked about it before, but I can give you more. Not as many, but there are people who have done it. Okay. So, other questions? Okay, so before it starts looking like I'm avoiding reinforcement learning because I don't know how to teach it, so I should go back to it. Okay, you took down the notes, right? I actually did want to talk about this, even though it looks like I was just avoiding that, because it's a good way of connecting heuristics and also connecting FFHOP and LRTDP, the two planners that you talked about. And if you understand this, you more or less understand where the state of the art is in probabilistic planning, and so it's a useful background. Okay, so for the reinforcement learning, it's in MDP framework. In fact, one of the interesting things is, let's start from here, okay? By the way, I'll tell you that, you know, these are slides by Dan Klein, essentially, so I didn't even make them, but I added some other things, so we'll just look at, okay, so reinforcement learning has been around for a long time in psychology. Okay, and basically people, all the psychologists felt, behaviorists, for example, felt that you can always change the behavior of, you know, animals by rewarding them in the right way. When they do the right things, give them a, you know, like something to eat, and when they do the wrong thing, give them a little shock. You know, that's why, you know, generations and generations of rats have been, you know, shocked, right? And in fact, you know, I think, one of the interesting things is that behaviorists were like at the top of psychology, you know, in the early part of 1900s, okay, which is early part of 20th century. So they know that if you give rewards and you can provide a proper mechanism design, then you can make the animal learn anything. And right now, when you do dog training, that's exactly what you do, more or less. Okay, now the question, of course, is how do you do this on computers? So how can you make programs learn from rewards? Okay, the interesting thing is it took a while before the connection between MDPs and reinforcement learning was made. So reinforcement learning existed before. Everybody wanted to do this because we believe that's what people actually do. Turns out, actually, that there is a pure behaviorist position which says there is nothing other than rewards and actions. Okay? So in fact, the idea Pure behaviorist position is what we will see in today's class as model-free reinforcement learning. So the animal doesn't actually need to have a model of what its actions do. Okay, it doesn't need action with this probability goes to this state, this probability goes to this state. If it has that, it can actually avoid shocks, think about it, and figure out what's the optimal policy. Okay, one of the interesting points that, you know, that was there in the psychological community, and especially Skinner, who was like a proponent of behaviorism, was, you know, you give enough behavioral, you know, if you do enough stimulus response, you know, trials, people can learn anything. And those of you who have taken 471 know that I always keep telling you about this part, that if that is case, if that is the case, AI is out the window. Why? What? If in fact everything worth doing can be learned completely by stimulus response trials, then AI as a discipline is kind of iffy. We are doing a lot of things that are unnecessary. In particular, the entire knowledge representation is out the window. Why the heck do I need to represent knowledge? I have no knowledge. All I know is if I go here, I get pain. If I go here, I get pleasure. That's it. Okay? And so in fact, Skinner, for example, said the entire language is learned by just stimulus response, for example. You know that kids learn language from their parents, from examples. And whenever they use wrong grammar, parents slap them. And whenever they use right grammar, parents give them a big cookie. And apparently that's how they're learning language. Okay. And now it turned out that that was totally not true. In fact, it's not very obvious in the context of human learning as to whether, I mean, there are very few scenarios where there is compelling evidence that internal knowledge representation is like required. One such scenario is language learning. And, you know, Noam Chomsky became very famous because he essentially pointed out that there is no child who gets enough stimulus responses to learn the amount of language they seem to know by the time they're 4 years old. Even if they never slept, even if all their parents and their extended family never slept, still they would not learn the language they learned. The only way they learned the language they learned is because they're coming in with inbuilt universal grammar, and the knowledge that they're, that the trials they're getting are only being used to tune the grammar. So this was this universal grammar idea, and that if the child was to be put in the middle of a bunch of you know, cows or wolves, even if they get all the stimulus response, they will never learn wolf language or the cow language, if there is one. Okay, but they will learn all of the human languages. You can take somebody from Tempe, put them in Mombasa, and they'll learn the local language completely. And you put any of you there, you'll die, because by now you have no hope of learning language. Okay, beyond 12, we lose the ability to learn language. Okay, I mean, first language at any rate. Okay, so there is reinforcement learning was available, and the question was, if you want to do it on the computer programs, what would be the best substrate to do it in? And it was in the end of 70s is when it was sort of realized that MDPs provide a pretty darn good substrate. So we now act as if reinforcement learning is just another arm of MDPs. But that wasn't the way it was supposed to be originally. Okay? So if you're thinking in terms of MDPs, you have a set of states, set of actions, a model, and a reward function. When I say model, this is what I mean. Model basically means action description. And this is the unfactored action description. And a factored action description would be like a strips action, right? And a reward function. Notice that that's also part of the knowledge of the MDP. If I give this, then we are trying to find the optimal policy. That's the basic idea. Okay, if I'm given all of this, finding the optimal policy is a pure inference problem. And that's what we did in the last several classes. Now, what if I stop giving some of these? In particular, suppose I don't give you model. So you know the actions. I mean, you may know what the actions are, but you don't know exactly where they will lead you to. The even weirder case is when MDPs normally say model is not available, they assume that the action names are available. It's just that they don't know what the probabilities are. But oftentimes, actually, when we say we don't know the model, we don't even know what the actions are. I mean, like, for example, one action might be that. And if I didn't know that I'm supposed to do that, I won't do it. Right? Right? The fact that after I do it, something happens is beyond the, you know, is a different question. So you sort of assume that there is a finite number of actions, you just don't know what they will do. That's what is not having the model supposed to mean. And the reward is, what is the reward you are expected to get if you reach a certain state? That too may not be given. Okay, that's a good point, right? If you're a kid, actually, you look this thing, oh, that looks red, I put my hand, plant on it, and then I realize the reward is pretty negative. So they learned the reward model at that point of time. Yes?
Why does the neural function have a state action state?
No, because that's, which one? This one. No, as I said, remember the when I was talking about MDPs, this is the most general model you can have, which is the action's reward depends not only on both the state you're starting from and the state you end up in. But if you think that the action always has a single cost, then you can always say RSAF dash is equal to a cost of A, and you ignore the states. In some other scenarios, it could depend on S and F dash. So the more general model assumes the reward depends on the state you came from and the state you came to. It's still Markovian reward, remember. Okay? So, anyway, so what if I don't have D and R, and I still want to, solving an MDP means solving the, finding the optimal policy. That's normally what it means. Okay? And in particular, since we have spent all this time on MDPs, solving an MDP could also mean solving the value function. You just want to know how good each state are, even if you don't know what action to do when. In fact, if you get the value, you get the policy. Yes? Except, except under certain cases, when you have the model, if you get the value, you can get the policy, and vice versa. In other cases, it's not. So in fact, today we will see that when you start losing either T or R or both of them, then in fact, there is a distinction between model-free learning versus model-based learning. Okay, so all of reinforcement learning is when T and R are not available, so don't know which states are good and what my actions do, must actually try actions in the states to learn. And experience the reward and then try to kind of credit blame assign, saying, you know, anytime I'm starting from S0, I seem to be overall feeling really sad. So try avoiding getting into S0. Or in particular, S0 seems to be a bad state. That's what you're trying to learn. Okay, now before I go into the specific algorithms, I thought I'll put you, two slides actually. One is, which are basically main dimensions over which reinforcement learning algorithms differ. Okay, one is model-based versus model-free. First, again, in the beginning, as a full of today's class and maybe part of next class, we will talk about atomic reinforcement learning models. Then we'll do factored. The usual way, okay? So model-based versus model-free. Model-based means I have been given or I will learn as part of my learning a model of the world. And then use it to figure out what is the optimal policy. Now, a model-free means skip the model. All I need to do is do the right thing. Remember that $64 billion question in AI is, what's the next thing to do? Everything else is just, you know, bookkeeping that you may want to put in your head, but nobody really cares. Right? If you do the right thing for the wrong reasons, you still win. Right? So ignore the model, just directly learn what action to do when. And if you do this, then this is model-free. Notice that model-based will still learn what actions to do when, but it learns an intermediate step. And if you are coming from MDPs into reinforcement learning, which do you think is going to be more familiar to you, model-based or model-free? Model-based. So in fact, model-based reinforcement learning looks suspiciously like policy evaluation, and you just call it learning. Okay, and model-free reinforcement learning looks at least slightly different. It turns out it's an approximate way of doing policy evaluation. Okay, So that's one dimension. The other dimension is passive versus active, which is, am I just sitting around doing, you know, following a certain policy that people, somebody gave it to me, and I'm just trying to figure out what states do I like and what states don't I like? Or am I actually trying to find the optimal policy? Now, of course, finding the optimal policy is active, and you know, finding the optimal policy is a more general problem than just finding how good is the current policy. Now, I call this passive because if I'm looking at you and you are going from state to state doing various actions, and I'm trying to figure out what are the values of various states for you with respect to your policy, then I'm just I don't need to change your policy. You already have a policy. So I'm passively looking at you and recognizing what the values must be for the state that you are going through. So passive learning is useful if you are sort of, you know, either you just have a default policy or you are just, you know, observing somebody else's behavior. Active is the more general, where you do both. Okay? Those are that's one dimension, that's one of the dimensions. The third dimension, which is actually more deeper down, and there's also a fourth dimension. The third and fourth are, the third one is extent of backup. And I'll just say it once, but we'll come back to it later. We'll find that oftentimes what will happen is, if I have a state and I'm trying to find its value based on its neighbors, right? Remember the LRTDP versus normal value iteration? Normal value iteration looks at S0, looks at the entire set of neighbors, okay, as defined by all the possible actions that it can do and the various states it can get to, and then in one cell swoop, it does Bellman backup, and it finds what is the value of S0. If you're doing policy evaluation, it just basically, with respect to the policy, it only does that particular action's all possible outcomes. If it's actually finding the optimal policy, it has to consider all the actions, expected value backed up by each of the actions, take the maximum of them. Add to that the reward of the S0, and that would be the value of S0. This is Bellman backup. Right? What was LRTDP doing? LRTDP, on the other hand, went one trace and sort of tried to back up with respect to that one trace. In LRTDP, actually, even though I had only one trace, so remember S0 and S1, and you know, there was Q values for S1, and then the best Q value I remembered here. Remember that picture I kept showing last time? Except in computing the best Q value, not only did I look at the current state that is encountered, but all the other states values are being used. So I would say this is the most eager way of backing up. Looks at the entire set of states and their values. This is sort of approximating this. And you will see in RL, actually, you don't what you would wind up doing is you will just look at the current trace. Well, if you remember, you read this stuff already. So temporal difference learning, for example, tries to make individual states' values be a little closer to their neighbor's values as constrained by the dynamic programming equation. Except dynamic programming equation is not between the correct, the specific neighbor that you experience in the current trial, but all possible neighbors you can get. If you use all of them, you would be doing dynamic programming, the full DP, Bellman backup. Temporal difference learning essentially just looks at only the parts that are experienced and tries to use that. Huge distinction is made about this little point. It turns out it's a big point, even though it looks like a big little point, because in temporal difference learning, you don't need to know actions. You don't need to know their model. You only need to know how the world is evolving. That's all. And that's why it's an advantage. It's a classic model-free learning algorithm, temporal difference learning. Okay? So that's extent of backup could be full DP or temporal difference, for example. Now, even in the case of temporal difference, it turns out that, you know, there is a temporal difference that is described in the textbook, and TD lambda, which basically tries to update a state's value, not just based on the next state in the sequence, but all the states in the sequence. So the farther away ones affect this guy's value less, as given by lambda power some value. I mean, it's discounted by lambda power k, where it's k far away. Okay, that's TD lambda. You know, in fact, the textbook doesn't talk about it, but if you read any other reinforcement learning chapters, you know, you talk about TD lambda algorithms. Okay, so it's just a question of how much are you exploiting your little single trace. In this guy's case, it's not a single trace, it's the entire world. It's looking at the entire world. And to be able to do this, you need pseudo experience. You need to be able to have the model so that you can actually know what states you can reach. When you do a single action, you only get to know its single outcome. You have to do it multiple times to get all its outcomes. Okay? So if you want to do this, and you are doing actual execution in the world, how do you do the full DP? First, you need to learn the model. So first, as you do like, you know, 10,000 traces, in these 10,000 traces, all you are trying to figure out first is, when I do action A from S1, you know, I did action A from S1 here in this trace, again here in this trace, again here in this trace, again here in this trace. So there are three different examples. And see how which state it's going to. And then compute the relative probability. That would give me an approximate model of the action. Once I have the approximate value of model of the action, then I can just do full DP. If you do that, that's called adaptive dynamic programming. Why is it adaptive? First, you're adapting the model. You weren't given it. And then you're doing policy evaluation. Okay? So those three are main dimensions that you want to keep in mind as you are going through this lecture, as well as, you know, your reading. The fourth one, of course, is there are many other ones I'll add later, but, you know, of course, you know for sure that the factoring will come in. That would be a different dimension. Whether you're doing factored reasoning or, you know, atomic reasoning. Okay. You know, there are lots and lots of good examples reinforcement learning. In fact, as the textbook says, the very first AI program that, you know, made a big difference was what? Is that the Samuel's Checkers program? And Samuel's Checkers program, at that time, he didn't think that he was doing reinforcement learning because the terminology didn't exist. But it turns out that you can understand it completely in terms of reinforcement learning. And he was able to do well. I mean, this was the 1940s, or late 1940s or early 50s. And he was able to beat humans in checkers. And then a more recent one is backgammon, where you are able to beat human performance in backgammon. Okay, and then there is also, in fact, this kind of theory of reinforcement learning can also be used to learn, for example, very complex things like inverted pole balancing. Okay, so I have a pole standing on top of a, you know, a cart, and I mean, if I leave it like this, the pole will fall off. But if it's about to fall off this way, I jerk it which way? Like that. And if it falls off this way, I jerk it this way. This is called bang-bang control. Okay, you bang this way, bang that way. The question is how to do this bang-bang control such that the inverted pendulum will stay vertical. And that's a policy. You're learning a control policy. It's a continuous policy. And if you are taking a reinforcement learning class, that would be one of the things that you would do as an exercise almost. And in the continuous domain, a very impressive thing is Andrew Ng, who actually gave the Computational Thought Award this year. I don't know whether I have the picture here, but maybe I'll go back. I think I have a picture. I'll come back to this one. So he basically, I don't know where it is. Yeah, that's his helicopter. It's a toy helicopter, thankfully. And doing inverted flying, which I'm told, you know, what do I know? I mean, I think, you know, the whole flight to me is magic. But I'm told that if you know how to fly helicopters, this is a pretty hard thing to do. To me, I'll anyway crash it from the day one itself. But even if I'm a good pilot, it's extremely hard maneuver to learn. And he essentially has his program done it automatically. You know, in all these cases, what happens is you do train, self-train. You know, in fact, in backgammon 2, basically what it did is it self-trained itself. So it generates random games and plays against itself. Okay, and that's how it learns. And then, you know, basically when you are sleeping, it's learning. And then when you wake up, it creams you. Right? That's actually an advantage if you either have a simulator or a model. Kids, on the other hand, can't self-train. I mean, the very beginning kids, right? I mean, what's this kid going to do? So tomorrow I will see, I'll put my hand on the green things, red things, and blue things. Red thing, ooh, I will feel what? I don't know. Until I do it, I don't know. Do you understand what I'm saying? Some cases self-training is possible, some cases it's not possible. Sometimes there is nothing substituting for experience. Sometimes you have enough experience and you just did not exploit it. Self-training allows you to exploit it. If you have a simulator, you'd be fine. If you have a model, you'd be fine. It's more than that. It's basically knowing that certain states are bad. See, in backgammon, at least the backgammon, basically the every player will know when the game ended and whether it was a good thing or a bad thing for it. What's hard in all these game playing programs is intermediate states don't give you any reward. So you don't quite know until you hit the end whether the intermediate states were good or bad. So the only way you can do is you have to simulate all the way to the end and then backpropagate the values. This is called credit blame assignment problem in reinforcement learning. It's a big deal. Okay? And in fact, I mentioned last class that in a backgammon problem, it's only a few number of iterations and then it can hit the end. Suppose there are ends that I can't even imagine. They just take too long to even simulate in my head. Then I need to essentially make my agent, I'm designing my agent, and I want the agent to learn efficiently, to do the right thing. But the right thing is at the end of the world. So for example, the right thing is what? What's the right thing? Right thing is to be remembered in favorable terms after you're dead and gone. That's a great right thing. Right? In fact, no, if you, that's the only thing that really matters. Okay, everything else is a detail. The question is, how do you optimize for that? Short of dying and finding out. In fact, some people, you know, that I know have sent fake obituaries of themselves to see whether people are missing them or not. And the really sad thing is nobody misses you. And then you know, you don't know whether to come back or not. Right? Anyway, so the question, of course, is what do you do in those cases? How do you simulate to improve your behavior? What we do in real life is we do reward shaping. Okay? Nobody ever said coming out of high school is anything useful. Nobody ever said that getting an A+ grade in any course is anything useful. Mine are different, but you know, most courses, it doesn't matter. Right? All that matters is if you are remembered well or not in the end. All of these I just made up. These are pseudo rewards. I shape the world for you so that you feel as if you know what to optimize for. The problem with reward shaping, this is called reward shaping in psychology literature, and we do it in AI too. The problem with the reward shaping is that a clever enough agent will optimize its behavior to pseudo rewards rather than to the reward that matters. Which is why there are a whole bunch of you here who know how to get A pluses in courses left and right and don't know how to write a dissertation that will be remembered. And that's why you're trying to learn that. And even that may not matter. Do you understand what I'm saying? So reward shaping is one way you actually make self-training feasible. You know, when the actual reward is given only much, much later. Okay. So passive learning. This is the first idea we're going to try, where passive learning means already somebody knows what the policy is. I mean, there's a policy that you're following. All you're trying to figure out is how good is a state given my policy. Since I know my policy, I don't need to know what action I'm supposed to do in each state, because that makes no sense. I'm already doing the action. My question is, if I'm doing this, how good is this state? Okay. And so goal is, the only goal in passive learning, the simple goal is learn the state values, that's it. Okay, this is much smaller than finding the optimal policy, because I'm giving you a policy and you're learning the state values. Now what is it called? There's a name for it. If I give you a policy and you're trying to learn the state values, what is it called? Policy evaluation. And remember, there are dynamic programming equations, and for policy evaluation, dynamic programming equations are linear equations. There is no max term. It's actually the easy thing to do. Why do we need a separate thing to talk about here? Because those equations use the transition model. I didn't give you the transition model. So how do you figure out? Okay, there are two ways. If I didn't give you the transition model, and I can do this called Monte Carlo simulation, or basically try various traces and see how much reward you get. And whenever you start from a state and you do a bunch of trace until you die, and then you find out the cumulative reward for the state for that one trial, you do it 10,000 times, you take the average. That would be the average reward that you, average aggregate reward that you can get from that state. So you could do it. Here is one episode. It started from 1-1, and then I went up, and it turned out that I did go to 1-2. It's a stochastic domain. When I tried to go up, I could have gone this way, remember? But my world actually let me go up this time around. And so I 1-2, and then 1-2, again I do up, and then 1-3, I did right, and so on. And I know, basically the rewards that they're using are slightly different. You know, the old Russell examples, we used to have 0.04 as the reward, -0.04 as the reward here, and +1 and -1 there. This one is saying +100, -100, you know, inflation over the last few years. And the costs are also -1 for each of the states. Okay? And so, I have these traces. And of course, based on these traces, I can find U of 1-1 is, I've done two traces. One time I got 92, another time I got -106. Okay, so I get a nice average, which is -7. So U11 is -7, and U33 is 31.3. Okay, how did I get U33? Actually, I can take the same trace and consider from 33 onwards. That's a trace. And here is 33 onwards. That's a trace. Why can I do this? So I thought this is almost like what I was saying in that FF thing. This is supposed to be this guy's day, right? So he, 1-1, was going all the way to be done dead or done alive. And then after you got the trace, now 3-3 is coming in and say, hey, no, this is also my trace. Okay, which is fine because this part of the trace starts from 3-3. And it's a MDP, Markov decision process. So it doesn't matter how you got to 3-3. The value of 3-3 depends only on the fact that you started from 3-3. Right? So in a way, actually, the traces are more useful than you may have thought. You don't have to, you know, every middle state, you have an effective trace for that. It's sort of like what we did for the FF triangle tables, essentially. Okay? So that's what we do. And you do this, you can compute the values. And if you do enough of these traces, you will get the values correct. What's wrong with this? Yes?
One problem is that, similar to what we discussed in planning, that it doesn't predict unlikely states. So you wouldn't draw the most unlikely states. So you wouldn't have.
That's true. That is true. But that's true, that's just based on the traces. But there is another problem, which is that what I'm doing, by the way, is doing policy evaluation empirically. And I used this as the straw man idea when I came up with the policy evaluation techniques. You remember that? I said, this is how you define the policy's value, but if you have any brains, you don't use it directly. Why don't you use it directly? Because these are all not independent variables. You're not trying to compute the values of a bunch of independent variables. They are completely dependent on each other. They are dependent on each other in terms of the values of the neighbors and the policy using the Bellman backup. Yeah? So that's why you are way better off solving a set of linear equations which will take into account these connections between the value of neighboring states that you would miss here. So this would get there, but it will take a much longer time to you know, the textbook shows the pictures, it will take a much, much longer time to converge to the right value. Whereas if I solve those linear equations, I can get there much faster. Yeah, but I'm talking about passive learning right now, which basically means I have a policy. Okay, by the way, keep that, and even when we get to active learning, it would still be the case that solving dynamic programming equations would be better than doing this kind of trial and error. This will never be better. Okay, even without max, even with max, this will still not be the better idea. Okay, so but we know that this will be a wasteful way of computing the value of the policy. Right, a value of a policy is the value vector for the state, right? And then this is a very wasteful way because it does not realize that values of neighboring states are correlated by the Bellman equation. So by ignoring it, you will basically recompute, what would have directly come through those equations. And so you will need many more traces. So since it misses the correlation between the values of neighboring states, it will be wasteful. So something went over there, but basically the idea then is use the real policy evaluation idea. What's hard about it? To do the policy evaluation, I essentially need the transition model. Remember, the value of a state f is equal to the reward of that state plus expected value for the action that you're going to take. If the action A1 takes you to S1 with probability P1, S2 with probability P2, and Si with probability Pi, then expected value of Pi times value of Si. Sum. That's what it is, right? And you're solving these linear equations. So all you need is that probabilities. But I didn't give it to you. So compute it. So basically, use the same traces to compute the action model. Now the point is, action model can be computed much faster with much fewer traces than you would need to get the values to converge. If you learn anything from samples, the only thing that matters is how many samples do you need to get to the real value, right? And remember, these are real, actually doing stuff in the world. And so this could mean a difference between your kid completing primary school by the time she is 5 years old, no, no, 10 years old, versus completing it by the time she is 67 years old. You know, if they do a lot more, you know, samples and then trying to figure out what's the best value, it could take forever. Okay? So basically, I go to model-based learning. So this one basically doesn't care about models, right? Because it's just watching the behavior and feeling the reward. Okay, now of course, there is no reinforcement learning where rewards cannot be felt. If you can't feel rewards ever and ever and ever, you can't learn a thing. And I talked to you about that, you know, previously too. In fact, you know, I mean, a really bad example I remember is my family doctor, you know, he used to have diabetes. And then one time, it turns out that one of the things that happened is he had a part of his leg which lost its sensation because of some complication with respect to diabetes. So he has no pain there. Even if you press something, he won't have any pain. So one time he stepped on a huge piece of glass or stray blade or something and he cut himself, didn't notice, until there was a huge amount of blood much later. And then that set gangrene and he passed away. Okay, it's not a good story to, you know, end the class with, but the point is, the reason he passed away is because he didn't get the reward signal. You guys, we all think badly about pain when we are having migraine. But if you don't have pain, you're dead the first day, because the happy day when you put your hand on the red stove, you would be in gone. Okay, so reward signals have to be felt. So you do feel these reward signals when you are in that state. If there are no reward signals in that state, that's fine. But if the entire MDP has no reward signals you can feel, bye-bye to learning. What are you learning? Nothing. Okay? But you can use the same traces to compute try to come. So you, first time you go to a state, you can get that, you can experience the reward of that state. You don't need to go to that state second time because you know that it's the same every time. Okay? And you can compute the models basically by saying, look, from 3-3, if you do right, once I went to, from 3-3, if I do right, once I went to 3-2, and then another time I also went to 3-2, right? And you know, if I have other 3-3s, in this, there's one more 3-3 I did right, I got to 4-3. So of the three times I did right from 3-3, one time I went to 4-3. So the probability of going to 4-3 from 3-3 when I do right action is 1/3. Simple arithmetic. You don't need a huge number of episodes for this to converge. So the model converges way before the value function converges by empirical training. The moment you got the value model converged, you do policy evaluation. Now you have a model, you solve a set of linear equations, either using, you know, Gauss-Seidel method or just do value iteration. Actually, you can do value iteration even when it's a linear set of equations, and that would get you to. Okay, see the convoluted way we got to the point that we already were 2 weeks back, right? By giving up what we knew, which was the model, we needed to learn that. And for you to understand that this is a good thing compared to this is extremely important. It needs to be really internalized. Okay, it looks like both of them are doing traces. What's the difference? Well, the difference is, how many traces do you need? All of you are going to classes. So what's the difference between you and some other person? You know, some people get the class like the first time they hear it. And some take it 3-4 times and still get a bad grade. So the rate of learning, you know, does matter. And these guys, you know, with the ADP, what we did there basically is called, what we just did there here is called approximate dynamic programming. In fact, it's just policy evaluation. Now the interesting thing is, and this is the last thing and you can get to go after this, if I've already computed the model, remember I was supposedly in the passive learning stage, but I already computed the model, I have the rewards, why should I only compute the policy, current policy's value? Why don't I just compute the optimal policy? Right? So all I need to do is, instead of doing summation, I do max over all the actions for that summation and then do the real value iteration, I will get the optimal policy. Right? What's wrong with that? What is wrong with that is, you will get the optimal policy if your model was complete to begin with. And if you started here and only did these actions, you would never ever have reached these states. And so you would never have seen that you could have had a better way of going to the goal. So true ADP essentially not only needs to find the greedy policy, but also once in a while do actions that are not suggested by the greedy policy. That's the exploration part. If you do that, then in the limit, you are guaranteed to converge to the optimal policy. I'll stop here. We'll take it up from, take it from here and talk about temporal difference learning, factoring, and all that fun stuff.